So, Anne, you can't see them, but Martin and Will are there.
Hi there.
Hi, Anne. We can see Anne.
Okay.
Can you see her? I thought you were looking at my screen.
I am looking at your screen, but I've got your, the window is up here too. We're not doing multiples. If we were doing multiples, if we had three or four on in the group, we'd lose it. So we're seeing y'all just fine.
Oh, okay. Okay. So
let's see. That is full screen.
No, that's...
Wait a minute. Let me move this.
No, that's
okay.
Oh.
You want to go, I think it's like F11 or
I'm full screen.
No.
I'm not?
No.
Well, okay.
If you go full screen, then from there to there will be the entire screen. It won't have these controls.
If I do F11, will that do it?
I don't know if F11 will. Yeah.
Oh. My God, you just taught me something. Thank you, Martin.
Sure.
We can all learn till the very end.
Yeah, till the very end. Yeah. Oh, this is my 72nd birthday today.
Wow. That's so wonderful, Will.
And I told one of the other old guys at the health club, you know, I said, look, I'm 72. Do I look okay? Yeah, he says, but I heard that getting old is like toilet paper. And I said, well, how's that? It says, the closer to you get to the end, the faster it goes.
That's so true. Well, that also means you're enjoying your life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very much. And this is very much part of a joy in the life because I feel like we're going to do some good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's so wonderful. I agree. Yeah. I agree. It's so important, this stuff, isn't it?
It's big, critical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
No, it is critical.
Yeah.
So let me just say, Fran is on vacation. She emailed me. She's away. Jeff is sick, and Lisa is sick.
Oh, goodness. No.
Yes. And she's leaving on a plane tomorrow, so she came over, and she dropped off a present for me. She gave me these two teas, which we can partake of today.
Yeah.
Ginger and green Moroccan mint, which is very sweet of her.
Very sweet. Yes.
So that's that. And so, I'm going to ask the question, but first I'm going to say my opinion of this chapter. This chapter, first of all, I learned so much and it reoriented me to the current, how we got to the current. And number two, I got to the, to the library, and some of the resources I have, I've only put one up so far on the website, but I'm going to put the other chapters from three or four of Stephen's sources that are incredible sources. I just, reading them was so fascinating and really to the heart of the matter of the monetary system.
Mm-hmm.
So this week, I'll be able to put them, scan them and put them up on the website. And if it's hard to read, you can, you know, print them off.
You know, I have to talk to you after the class about how to get on the part of the website that I need to be on.
Yes.
Because I can't figure it out.
Okay. I can show you after the class. Yeah. Yeah. So what did other people think?
Well, it seems like the first appearance of the idea of creating money out of nothing and fractional reserve, those concepts come into play. You can see those beginnings of modern private banking right away. They're in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Long time ago they started.
Yeah, they do. I was also struck by the fact that the princes were regarded as a high risk of people to loan to. So they didn't get loans, so they ended up debasing the currency system, which I thought was, I found that very interesting.
Yes, that's one of the reasons why they had to debase the currency. We'll talk about that when we get to the point in the chapter. There's probably we could probably figure out between the four of us the three or four real good reasons why they were forced to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they, anyway. What'd you think, Will?
I don't know what I thought. I read it, but then I don't know what I read.
It is a blur, isn't it? I found myself going online and looking up Bruges and Liebeck and, you know, just looking at the geography.
Yes, yes.
And that I somehow, one thing led to another, to all the burnings of people and...
They beheaded some bankers.
Yes. And the 30 years war.
And the 100 years war.
I didn't get to that.
Yeah.
How did I miss? Oh yeah, right at the end.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah, a lot of war.
And I thought the 30 years war, I used to think that it was over, all the princes had different religions depending on what they personally decided to adopt, and then their little princedom had to follow along, everybody. And I thought that the war was over that. It really isn't. So.
Boy, I'll tell you, I went online to Wikipedia a number of times because I don't know all the history. And Wikipedia doesn't talk about the money at all.
No.
Oh my God. It's been taken out of our history.
But the other things are so huge that it's almost like, well, who cares about the money? I mean, more than half the population of Germany was lost.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's probably connected in some way to the money. Because that affects everybody.
Yeah.
All the people.
Yeah.
You know. So, let's get started because this is quite a long chapter. And I didn't even put everything in Stephen's chapter into the presentation.
Yeah.
Okay, so here it is, The Lost Science of Money, Chapter 6, The Renaissance Struggles for Monetary Supremacy. And I just have two of the actors in here, and there's probably other ones. But one's the King's Mint, his prerogative to coin the money of the realm. And there is the Medici Bank with the bankers and their customers and their bookkeeping and everything we know about at this point about their creating bookkeeping entries as money. And they're dressed very, very well for bankers, I think. And there's the struggle. And just to repeat, thinking about this chapter and thinking about the primary importance of the money power, of course now we're getting into credit, so you know that's right there. The money purposely kept secret and confused. I just talked about how the history doesn't have it in it, right? How a society defines money determines who controls it. So now we're getting different definitions of money in the Renaissance. And the battle over the control has raged for millennia. It's gone right up to the present, from the Bronze Age. And this is very specific to the Renaissance, the public versus private nature that's coming up. So the parts of the presentation, this presentation, a lot of it is based on Stephen's sources. So there's a little bit more of an acute focus on certain things, okay? So we have the 13th century revolution in money, the 13th century revolution in trade, the King's Mint, the international merchant bankers. And then there's a section on credit and Bruges, yeah.
Depending on which language you want to pronounce it in.
Right, one's French and one's
Bruges would be the French and the Flemish would be Brugge.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Flemish, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And looking at the Brugge, there were different kinds of money created, so we're going to talk about that. There was deposit banking and there was the international banking. And then the Hanseatic League, which is the war on credit. So that's a lot to cover.
Yes, it is.
It's a lot. So we'll go slow, but we won't go slow. You know, I mean, we need to talk about the concepts, I think.
Oh, the other thing I noticed was, if I remember this correctly, because I swept through it yesterday afternoon, but he started to bring up how no one was questioning the morality of the systems.
Nobody in the sources that he read, it was who was not questioning it. The historians,
the people who lived in those times were not questioning the morality of their methods.
Well, certainly not the bank.
No, but it seemed to me that I read that in there somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if they recognized. I mean, I wonder if the kings recognized it. I mean. I would think they would certainly have recognized it as a power that was opposing them. I don't know. What do other people think?
That's why they got rid of the Knights Templar, because of the banking power of the Knights Templar.
That's right. There you go. That's an example. Right. Also, Philip LaBelle owed them a whole lot of money. And kill your creditor. That's how it gets from out from under.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the 13th century, revolution in money. We're going to talk about money first, not the credit. Okay. So, this is based on a book by Spufford having to do with money during this period. And his focus is the commercial revolution of the 13th century, which he makes it the long 13th century, starting at 1160 and going all the way to 1330. So it's spanning the 13th century, but it includes the last part of the 12th century and the early part of the 14th. So this is his focus. This is where he feels like the major, major changes have happened in the money system. The long 13th century saw fundamental changes in money, credit, business practices, and the relations in society. So you have the coin, which is the money. You have the bankers in the middle, which is the credit. And then you have the peasants, the farmers, the Valens over on the right, and their relationship is going to change very radically with this commercial revolution. Okay.
Yeah.
More money. There's more money. More money than ever before during this period. Okay? You want to read this, Anne?
The commercial revolution of the 13th century, 1160 to 1330, the quantity of money in circulation increased, plunder of Constantinople. The plunder of Constantinople by the Venetians and other of the Crusaders probably transferred more metallic wealth to Western Europe than all the commerce of the centuries that preceded it. William Jacobs, The Precious Metals, 1831. The money power was dispersed from the religious to the secular. It was said that the total amount looted from Constantinople was about 900,000 silver marks.
Okay, so here's one source of this incredible increase in money at this point. The precious metals, which is what they considered the coin of the realm, okay? Will, you want to read this one?
Yeah, the same headline, the commercial revolution of the 13th century. The quantity of money in circulation increased. New wave of silver mining. Okay, under Argentine mine in Argentina.
Argentiera. It was cool. Argent was silver.
Argentiera. Argentina's silent.
Well, glad you're here. Okay. It has been calculated that Sardinian mines have supplied Pisa with almost 15 tons a year of the valuable metal in the period, stretching from the end of the 12th century to the beginning of the 14th century.
This is what we're focusing on, where the money increased.
Yeah. And is that Cutnahora, Bohemia?
Some eastern...
Yeah.
Well, Bohemia is part of Germany.
It is.
Or Czechoslovakia, right?
Czechoslovakia.
Okay. By 1260, German miners began to mine for silver in the mountain region. Yeah, that's up in the northwestern part of the Czech Republic, I think. Okay.
So here's another source of the incredible increase in money, coined money, in Europe. Okay. Now, the money increases. Something happens when you put together land and money in Europe at this point. Okay? And this is interesting because I have a group. Half of us are from the Henry George land value tax school. And we're trying to see the connections between land and money. So this is very, very interesting. Okay? Martin, you want to read that?
Yeah, sure. The commercial revolution of the 13th century, 1160 to 1330. Revolution in rents. Landlords demand money rents. More and more was let for money and replaced rent in labor or rent in kind. This benefited the wealthier peasant who could sell his produce for money, pay his rent easily, and even begin to buy land for himself. For their poorer neighbor, money rent forced him to work additional jobs off the land for money. Forced him to sell food meant to be eaten by his family, and meant a radical lowering of his standard of living.
That's pretty heavy when I started reading that.
Yeah.
And there were a number of peasant uprisings during these centuries. Mm-hmm. But it just hit home to what's going on today. You know, when you don't have access to land where you can grow your own food, you are dependent on money. And this is one of the things that's going on today. Because when they can control the money like they do today, they can control most of us. Because we don't have access to land. We're not there feeding our families off the land, you know. But here, the poor neighbor has, you know, it's like going out and getting two jobs. And listen, we can't have as much food on the table. Some of us might have to skip meals in order to pay the landlord. And a lot of that is going on in New York City today, you know. So the connection between land and money is really important. I'm glad this author focused on this. I'll read this. The money rent system could always advantage the landlord. Tenants now assume the risk of a poor harvest or a low sale price for their crops. Right? The increase in both money and Europe's population meant the landlord had the advantage of competition for tenancies. Right? Plenty of people around, you can't pay the rent, I'll find somebody else.
Yeah.
Inflation diminished the value of the money rents for the landlord, but he had many options. He could take back his land, farming it himself with low-paid workers. He could demand his current tenants pay part of their rent in kind, so he could go and get the money for it. And he could give shorter and shorter leases upping the rent as he did it, which they do in New York today. Rent for the prevailing market price of half the produce. Okay, so give me half the produce and I'll take the rest of the produce and I'll sell it. So he had a lot more options. So there was a lot of upheaval going on in the countryside because of this increase in the money and the use of the money. Ann, you want to do this?
A change in attitude to money. Resources were judged for money income. Forests, not for hunting or food. Cultivatable land and cash crops, not for eating or dues. Wine press to generate income. Grain mill to generate income.
So it's like the commodification we have today. Everything has a price and money, and that's the importance, and that's the focus, mm-hmm. you know. So here's where it started. Mm-hmm. Here's where it started. Does anybody have any thoughts?
No.
No? Okay.
Just like today.
What, Will?
Just like today.
Yeah. Yeah, this... Well, you know, this is the impact of this increase, huge increase in money that had not been there before. You know, you had the feudal responsibility of the lord to his the peasants and the peasants' responsibility to the lord. But now money is coming on the scene. And this presentation doesn't go in the direction of land enclosures. But that this is a period of when they started in England and parts of Europe.
I never realized it started that early, but yeah.
Yep.
What I'm hearing here is that there was a shift between the away from the primacy of social relations mm-hmm. to the primacy of commercial relations.
Yes.
Financial relations.
Yes, exactly.
Mm. You didn't care about the people, you just wanted the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the people who had the money and the power were the ones who didn't care about the people. Mm. You know. That's what I keep thinking today. We have to find the people and put them in the decision-making roles, the ones who do care. You know, who do care.
Yeah. However, did you read that? It was online somewhere. I got an email about it. A study in some university, very important study, and what it proved is that people, the more they have, the more they become haves and not have-nots, the less they care about other people. And they have all different ways of rationalizing why they shouldn't have to. It's ingenious the way they set it up with Monopoly games. It didn't matter whether you yourself, you could be very struggling financially, but if you thought you had power and that you were better than other people in the Monopoly game, let's say, you treated the other people badly. And it was horrible because it would seem like if caring nice people had power, then they wouldn't care anymore.
Well, you know, this is an interesting thought, but I think we should save it for when we have more time, because it opens up a lot of... Okay, let's save. Who's next?
I'm me.
Oh, okay.
A change in attitude to money. Resources were judged for money income. Philip of Lis, Count of Flanders from 1168, whose mints were among the first to actively provide more coin at the time, invested in drainage schemes to reclaim fresh land for its cultivation and sold his reserves of peat for fuel. The same count and his brother, Matthew, Count of
Boulogne,
were among the earliest founders of new towns for profit. Calais, Dunkirk, Newport, Dame, and Graceline, the men of Bourges and St. Omer almost at once organized the cutting channels suitable to bring seagoing vessels inland. The bankers and millers themselves.
The bankers.
Okay. Something we can't blame on the bankers. The bankers and millers themselves made so much profit that they joined the village elites of the richer peasants.
Yeah. So the whole society, countryside and sea.
So there you have a beautifully overdressed banker.
That's true. Look at him. Beautiful cloth from Flanders.
He had joined another world.
Yeah, well, he had opportunities, right? With the money.
Yeah.
Had opportunities.
Yeah. I remember when I sold Volkswagens, we got our first lug of the Touring, and all of a sudden, it brought in a different criminal class into our store. I mean, really, it was obvious the difference in these people and their secretaries that were coming in trying to find a ride to get work and take their kids to school. And these people were running for luxury.
Oh.
They were lots of them physicians, surgeons.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And they'd bring their families with them. That was what was interesting. They'd have their families of these rich kids with them that you never saw from the other class of people.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a different criminal class, like the baker in the middle here.
Martin, you're next.
All right. Town merchants become rentiers. The town merchants acquired more of the land in the towns. The steady rise in population encouraged building sites. The steady rise in rents caused many of them to give up trade and become rentiers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture of the house being built right there.
The half-timber house.
Again, notice the strong connection between the land and the money.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very strong. And today, I always think of this, because someone who's very smart pointed this out to me. She said, you know, you have to teach how the bankers, it's not just the money they want and the power. The ultimate goal is to own all the resources, all the land and what's under them. And that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're doing. Yeah. There was, the revolution in rents, you know, from rents in kind to money rents, increased the income of the princes because they owned the land, so they got the money rents, and therefore war. The rulers used their money income to hire mercenaries on a scale never before known. Rulers used their money income as security for loans from the bankers for even larger armies. Huge armies could now be amassed. Same as today, the bankers
and
driving it.
Wasn't there something in the chapter about a German ruler of a little German province found it more profitable to rent out
hire mercenaries?
Institute a draft, and then all the population had to go to war as his mercenaries, and he got all the payment that, you know, for that he charged the other countries for his soldiers.
Oh, I don't remember that, but
yeah, that's where you got the Hessians fighting.
Does anybody else remember that from the chapter? I don't remember that.
Maybe I read that somewhere else.
Maybe it's in another chapter.
Sounds very interesting.
No, that was in there.
Okay.
So one of the outcomes of more money is more war.
Great.
Who's next? Is that you, Martin? Is it Martin?
Well, revolution in the governing of states' salaries, paid with many fiefs, rather than giving them a feudal estate. The king could pay salaries to non-military officials in service. He was free to hire and fire them. This was the beginning of a post-feudal civil service.
Yeah, so, you know, the king didn't have to give away his land in order to get support. He could keep the land, which, again, is keeping his power because he's getting all those money rents from it, right? Is this you, Martin? I've lost track.
I think it is. I'm after Will.
Okay. You're right.
Revolution in rents. Development of town courts in capitals. Both king and nobles were not longer... Both kings and nobles were no longer tied to their estates. Capitals developed where the king's administration could remain permanently. The king's court attracted landowning classes who build noble townhouses near the court. And then there we have both medieval Paris and medieval London.
Yeah, beautiful cities, both of them, I have to say. And look at all those wonderful robes those people are wearing, and tapestries and everything. Wow. Maybe something. I think it's my turn. Revolution in rents, direct taxation in money on the peasantry on a much larger scale than ever before. Keep remembering, the money supply has increased dramatically. A major cause of the English peasants' revolt of 1380 was the heavy money taxation of the peasants. The money was needed by the crown to wage the Hundred Years' War with France. The direct taxation of the countryside was vastly greater than the indirect taxation of the cities. The countryside fell into long-term debt to the city. Farmers were compelled to concentrate on cash crops, and a cycle of deprivation was set up, not unlike the Third World today. Debt. Taxation and debt. I think this is you, Anne.
Revolution in rents increased money income for the church. Avignon and Rome as church capitals. And there we have Avignon, the papal palace, and in the Vatican City, Rome, the papal estate.
So they grew up because of all the money now. And of course, the church owned a lot of the land. And this book has examples of how in a very short period of time, like maybe 30 years, the one estate went from all of the peasant, this is a church-owned estate, all of the peasants paying in labor or in kind to like 80% now money rents that they had to find the money. Just like today, we have to find the money in order to live. So, crushing, actually. Yeah. Will?
The Revolution of
Rents. This is the book that this is taken from.
Okay. Quote, the flow of silver around Europe from the mining areas to the ports of which it left Europe for the Levant was thus not a simple flow, but one of the complex eddies of diffusion into the countryside and reconcentration in the towns. The places on which it concentrated were primarily those of political importance, where the nobility increasingly congregated. That's from Peter Spufford, Money and Its Use in Medieval Europe, page 249.
I love this description of the ebb and flow as it eddies, because we all know that is being drained ultimately to the east, to the Levant, and in back to India. But before it does that, it's going around Europe and causing all of this, you know, the increase in the money, causing all of this change. All of this change.
Yeah.
So that was the focus on the money, the coin, the silver, the gold, right? And the vast increase and the changes it wrought. Now we're going to look at the same period of time and what was going on with trade. Okay. Is this you, Martin?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
The revolution in trade. The increase in demand for luxury goods, backed up by the newly liberated quantities of ready cash from money rents, brought an enormous quantitative change in the volume of international trade. Peter Spofford, Money and Its Uses in Medieval Europe, page 251.
And you can see the routes between the East and the West that we're familiar with, the one through Alexandria and the Red Sea, and the other one through the Levant, Syria, and Iran.
But not the one around the bottom of Africa.
Not yet.
Not yet.
That's late.
That's 1503 or something like that. Yeah.
1503.
Yeah, not yet. That's a good point. Not yet. And the map on the left shows you the Venetian routes in red and the Genoese routes in yellow, and the overland connections that were going on in the blue. Okay. And there has the Hanseatic routes too. We'll get to that at the end of the end of it. Okay. So there's a quantitative change in the volume of international trade. I think back to the king's court and the nobles concentrating in the capital cities and the major towns, and their desire for luxury, because it's not the peasants who are getting the luxury goods. But there's a huge increase in the volume of international change. Again, coming from originally the huge increase in the actual coined money, the bullion money. I think next is my turn. Okay. The increase of demand for luxury goods. The courts and nobles moved to the towns and cities. They wanted luxury goods, and they had the money to pay for them, because they had the land, and they had the money from the land rents. The sugar in place of honey. This is interesting. Today we go the other direction.
Yeah, why would you want sugar?
I know. I guess it's new. It's new. Pepper, cloves, and other Asian spices. Luxury drinks like Rhineland wine, they wanted drinks from afar. Diamonds and pearls they wanted. High quality furs. And I'll just do this one too. They wanted, the largest market of all was for clothing and furnishings. You have this Flemish tapestry, and you can go to the Metropolitan Museum and see these huge tapestries from the medieval
era. The cloisters.
Yes, the cloisters. And then these beautiful people here. And it's interesting, I have a book that has the picture on the right in it. And I got this book a year or so ago. And it's written by an art historian. Mm-hmm. It's called Worldly Goods, A New History of the Renaissance by Lisa Jardine.
Oh my goodness.
And the whole book is about the luxury goods and how all the Renaissance art, like these pictures you see on the right, the two, when they painted these wealthy people, they were painting, they had to include all their luxuries. This is what these people wanted to display, and they wanted it displayed in their paintings. And the whole book is about this. It's fascinating. And you can see, you know, the detail of everything included, you know.
Are these pictures out of your book?
These pictures are off the internet. But this book has a lot of pictures in it, you know. And I was just struck because the author is an artist. Art historian. She's not a monetary historian, but she captures the money right from the start. She's focused on it, you know.
Yeah. Well, who had the money to pay for a tapestry and a painting? And then the artists themselves were extremely conscious of the rings and the beautiful chandelier and the mirrors and everything. And
look
this
at that mirror. Yes.
This mirror is. It gives you a. He painted the reflection in the mirror, too. So if you see it in real life, there's a clear reflection.
Oh, that's right. Look
yeah, it's
that.
One of those dome mirrors.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Anne has an art background, so she's good at this.
But I still don't know whether the woman is pregnant.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think she's not. I think the title is something like the Betrothed Couple. So, I don't know.
Look at his robe, though, and his hat.
The fur trim.
Yeah.
I have a fancy little dog.
Yeah.
Or maybe they just had to get married.
Well, I think that's the case.
Also, the other thing that this woman, this art historian in this book points out, the incredible debt that these wealthy people were in. They would hawk everything just to buy something else, you know. They really, really.
That sounds very familiar.
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, poor Rembrandt, he loved other people's art, you know, the other greats of his time, and he hawked everything to buy all this art, and then demand for his type of art sank, and he had to face bankruptcy, and everyone knew he was destitute. So they gave him pennies on a dollar for his artwork.
Oh, God.
Poor guy.
Jesus. And, I'll do this one too. There was a huge market for commodities for the military, right? Because of the increased war. You had to buy everything for your soldiers, right? So you had the armor for the horses, the armor for the men, and you had tournaments. This was the period when tournaments became very popular, you know. So all of this required money. Anne.
The trade fairs. I wish I could have gone to them. Princes sponsored great fairs to promote trade. Fairs were a free trade zone. Taxes were waived, disputes were set aside, and regulations were lifted. And over on the right we have, compradores, whatever they are, right. Anyway.
Do the next one too.
Food sellers.
Do the next one too.
Okay. Again, trade fairs. The merchants use payment clearing within the fair or between fairs. So we have merchant one. I have added up everything you bought from me. It is 300 gold coins. Merchant two, I've added up everything you bought from me. It is 200 gold coins. So the clearance, merchant one would receive 100 gold coins from number two, or merchant one will offer credit to two until the next fair.
So that's
fair enough.
This is the netting mechanism that's used today in check clearing. The same concept.
Checks and check clearing.
Yeah. The banks in the Federal Reserve System, they add up all of the checks from each bank, and then those other banks add up all the checks from their bank, and they say, okay, I owe you this. The other one says, I owe you, and they come up to the net, and the only thing that gets transferred is the net, not all the back and forth.
So they don't transfer the actual check, they just transfer the total.
Just the netting. And that's why the bank reserves in their account at the Fed doesn't have to be very much. Because they only have to transfer every night the net difference, never the whole amount. That's fractional reserve banking. That's how they do it. Yeah.
I'll have to think about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of songs about fairs. You know Scarborough Fair?
But underneath it, this is always going on. This is always going on underneath it.
Johnny's not home from the fair.
Okay. Now, so we talked about the money. We talked about the increase in the trade, and now we're going to talk about the international merchant bankers. I gave them special case here. Well, I think it's your turn.
When the concentration of demand and trade has passed a critical mass, qualitative changes took in the ways of doing business occurred. Traveling merchants were replaced by several different men with special functions. And they're the international merchant bankers. One is the resident merchant banker in northern Italy. Two is specialist carriers by land or sea. They developed the ships and the camel trade, it looks like. Full-time agents overseas or overland. So he had agents in other countries.
Yes, and other cities.
Yeah.
So this was the qualitative change. Remember, we've got the quantitative change in the money, right? And the quantitative change in the amount of demand for luxury goods and trade, right? And that led to this qualitative change, you know.
Yeah.
Martin.
The international merchant bankers. Over on the left there we have Constantinople Lighthouse, 1100s, agents to the Levant. Later, agents to the Italian Peninsula and Trade Fair. And over on the right we have London and Bruges, 1300, agents to the northern capitals and major ports.
So there's a gradual spreading out of their network over the course of this long 13th century. Okay.
Building a bureaucracy.
And it makes sense that the first agents would have been in the Levant, with what we know from what was going on with the Crusades and everything. Right?
Yeah, that's the 12th to 14th.
Yeah. Why don't you do this one also, Martin?
Partnerships become more permanent. Partnerships extended for many years. The capital of the company was divided into many shares. Shares were transferable. Shares were owned by families of the founders, principal employees, and investors. And the sedentary merchant was responsible to his shareholders.
Sounds familiar.
Yes.
Oh boy. Yeah. Are there a lot of small merchant bank companies and some big ones? Because the big ones were in northern Italy and in Florence and Venice and places like that. You can see Florentine bank branches in the 14th and 15th century are in yellow and red there.
All the way up to London.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And North Africa.
Tunis. And there's a book. Raymond de Ruyter is one of the sources. To create this presentation, I used another one of his books, not this one. But he's famous for his analysis of this period. Mm-hmm. And he from 1929 to 1938, focused on analyzing the oldest ledger of a merchant banker in Bruges. And that's how he came to understand what it was like back in that century. Yeah. Very, very good writer, too. Very clear. my turn. Oh, here we go. Oh, growth of mutual confidence among international bankers, okay? Suppliers and customers. Okay, so this mechanism is being developed and people are willing to use it, okay? Because they're anticipating that there's always going to be money out there. That's one of the things, right? It's based on knowing that this money is there, right? And the money has been increasing dramatically. So now they're going to start to use credit for their sales, okay? And they're going to create money on top of already the existing coin money that has already caused all the changes we've talked about, okay? So they're kind of like a parasite. That's the way I think of them. Buyers and sellers no longer have to carry precious metals overseas, right? Static managers, the ones who don't move around, the ones who stay in Northern Italy, send and receive payments by a something called a bill of exchange.
And this is something the Templars did.
Yes, they started this very early. It was perfected, the legality of it was perfected by 1300. So there were precursors to it, right? And here, now, let me explain this. I have struggled for years to understand bills of exchange because they use a whole lot of technical language and it's so confusing. So I tried to get rid of all the technical language, but when you read about it in other sources, it might be a little difficult because they use banking terminology like payee, payor, drawer, receiver, blah, 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 blah. But this is functionally, I tried to put functionally how a bill works. And a bill is equivalent, down at the bottom, is equivalent to a post-dated check, okay? So, on the left-hand side is Europe, is Italy in Europe, and in the right-hand side is Bruges in Flanders. And there's gonna be a bill between those two parts of the world. And so it starts in Italy, where a banker in Italy is going to loan some old coins to a borrower. And the borrower is the maker of the bill. The borrower is going to write the check. Okay? And you can see he signed it. The borrower in general signed that check. That's what this bill is. And of course the bills don't look like our checks, but they're a document. Right? And he's going to write the bill and he's going to say, I order you, my agent in Bruges, to pay this amount of money to this person who's the agent of this person I just borrowed the money from. So you can see the check that it's this check is drawn on the agent of the borrower in Bruges, right? And there's a future date to it. And he's going to give it to the agent of the banker in Bruges, who's in Bruges, and it's going to be for a certain amount of foreign currency. And that's basically what the bill is. It's a post-dated check. So this bill gets sent to Bruges. It gets sent to the borrower's agent, and he has it and he accepts it. That's one of the steps. It's called an acceptance. He accepts it. When he accepts it, he has taken legal responsibility for that loan. And the agent, at the time of the future payment, the agent will go to the borrower's agent in Bruges and get the gold coin with a little bit less than was borrowed because they have to hide the interest. So they hide it in this thing called the agio, which is the difference. And these are short-term loans, so the interest, if you And there's an example, and I don't have it right here, where he gives some examples of these loans. And the interest is generally around, yearly interest about 40%. But these would only be for a couple months, mm-hmm. you know. But if you extrapolate the interest for a whole year, it'd be like 40%. It's very high, you know. So that's the way that the bill worked. It's a post-dated check, and it's used internationally. The bank of the borrower is in the foreign country, and there's the agent of the banker who loaned the money. He has the agent in that same foreign country. And again, these international bankers were found in the major cities, the capital cities, the major seapoint towns, with all the trading was going through. And this became their business. And then what eventually happens is that the loans that are given and the repayments of those loans would both be done with bookkeeping entries. Forget about the metals, right? Credit would be given to the borrower in Italy. Okay? And then when it was repaid, a credit would be repaid with the angio, the difference. Doesn't it sounds just like today, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just like today. All done with the bookkeeping. All done with the bookkeeping. Just blows my mind. Ah. Okay. Anne.
Bankers and bookkeeping money. In many ways, this was a monetary power greater than the king's control over the mint. This bank money was a more true fiat money form and further removed from crude barter than the precious metals coins. But the bankers were usurping a power that derives from and belongs to society and using it for personal benefit.
That's an angio.
And that's where the morality, he touches on, you know, this yeah. is the immorality of it. Yeah.
Yes, and his sources really don't do that either. They're very academic. They're yeah. good writers.
Yeah.
They're good researchers. They see the relationships, but they don't go that extra step that yeah. Stephen does.
Yeah.
That's so critical for today's world. You know? God. Will.
Bankers control society. The Silver Famine, 1130 through 1307, the Knights Templar were the first modern bankers and controlled the export of silver from Europe to the East. 1345 plus continued the export of silver from Europe to the East. Venice applies to Egyptian government for reduction in tariff on silver imported by Venice into Alexandria from 10% to 2%, and taps into the Eastern ratio. Silver famine in Europe is the result.
This we went over in the last class, but I put it in here because this is still pertinent to what's going on. Though there is a lot more trade, a lot more money, a lot more trade, lot more credit, right? So we have other factors, but this factor is still there, okay? Okay, the King's Mint. Okay, Martin, why don't you read this?
The prince's controlled money. The minting of coin and spending into circulation. With the power to mint coins, the princes were given the power to control the amount of money in circulation. However, if bullion was leaving the country, the market price of gold or silver was above the mint price, and bullion would cease to flow to the mint. The stoppage of work at the prince was one of the main causes of princely debasement of the coins. By law, money changers were supposed to deliver all their bullion to the mint. This did not happen if they could sell it for a better price.
And the princes struggled. They had those laws, you know, I'm going to behead you if you... But it's so easy to hide those coins and get them out of the country. It's not very easy to do. And this is a theme that we've been dealing with for many weeks of when you have gold and silver, think of the empire of the Romans, and someone else has control of the value of that, you don't have control over your money. You know? Very, very similar to what went on back in the ancient world with the gold and silver.
And all because of the demand for luxury goods, and now the flow of silver to the east because they got a better exchange than the gold. And so if they had Lycurgus in charge, you would put an end to the luxury goods.
Exactly, exactly. And an end to the bankers, that's for sure.
That's right.
Yeah. No Lycurgus here in the Middle Ages. So I have to say the church did as much as they could stop the usury.
Yeah.
You know, but they didn't persevere with educating.
And the Hanseatic League tried to do their bit too to stop it.
They did, but for different reasons, I think. Than the church, you know. That would be an interesting class just on the motivation
yeah.
for different mm-hmm. attitudes towards credit, mm-hmm. you know. Okay, my turn. The prince's debasement of the coin, a solution for deflation. The debasement or devaluation of the silver groat by the prince was a help to the money changers. They would have their cash reserves recoined into a greater number of silver groats and still owe to their customers the same number of groats as before the debasement. So they made out great, actually. The debasement meant the prince would have greater seigniorage. The profit from spending newly minted coin after subtracting the cost of the bullion and creating the coin. However, the increase of the prince's seigniorage profit was decreased by the loss of income from other revenue sources which did not keep up with the rise in prices. So it wasn't so straightforward, you know, he needed more revenue. He was going to debase the currency and make more coins, mm-hmm. but yet he was dependent on these coins from his other revenue streams, and sometimes he lost money on that because of the rising prices. So there's some of the coins of the realm. Coins of the realm. Part five is to look at the actual credit, okay? These credit institutions. The we have the ones who are making money, the money changers became the local deposit banking. That's what they became. And of course, we've touched on the international banking. We're going to just talk a little bit more about the international banking. So you had the domestic bankers, which were the money changers, and you had the international bankers, which were the merchant bankers. Okay. Anne, why don't you do this one?
Coin brokering did not create money, credit, but it was usury. Pawn brokers lending at interest on the security of personal property. Because pawn brokers gave consumptive loans, the church considered them usury. However, many of the poor needed these loans to survive, and the government's fees were a source of revenue. So in many places, the government legalized them.
Right. But they didn't create credit. They just asked for a high interest, usury, you know, which itself disrupts the society, you know, in a very bad way. So money changes, local deposit banking. Will, why don't you do this?
Yeah, money changers had two original functions. First, exchange current coins for a fee. Two, purchase bullion from the public and sell to the prince's mint if profitable.
Yeah, they would do it if it was profitable. So those were the two original functions of a money changer, right? You know, you give me these coins from Italy, I'll give you the Bruges coins. These are Bruges, say these are Bruges money changers. You know, and I'm going to charge you a fee, an IGL for it, okay? And they were supposed to, the foreign coins they got, they were supposed to bring them to the mint. So the prince could buy them and then create his own coins, local coins, and spend that for himself. Okay. Why don't you do the next one, Will, too? Because it's all about this deposit banking.
Money changers assumed a third function, credit money creation. They began to accept deposits of coins called jetero, deposit banking. Number one, deposits. A deposit was transformed into money, into bank money, bookkeeping credit to the depositor's current account. The deposit did not earn interest, but could be transferred to other accounts in the same or a different bank.
And you can see the picture over there. They have just the bookkeeping books.
Yeah.
They're bookkeeping entries.
They don't have a treasure chest there with gold going in and out of
right.
it. Okay. At the same time, the bank used the deposits to invest in or loan to business ventures with interest in a concealed form. Money was created, purchasing power, risk was taken.
So here's money in two separate places. It's in the bookkeeping of the depositor, and it's in the bank's investment out into the world of trading and business.
Yeah.
Money creation.
And two, overdrafts. The depositor's current account could also go into overdraft, a bookkeeping loan. No interest was charged. Money was created. Purchasing power.
Yep. This is today's local bank.
Yeah.
Martin, why don't you do this one?
Okay. The exchange banks created purchasing power or money as effectively as if they had been granted the privilege of issuing notes. De Ruwe, Money, Banking and Credit in Medieval Bruges, page 321.
321.
By tacit understanding, the depositor permitted the banker to use the money that he had deposited or that was credited to his account by transfer, in return for safety and the service of transfer, page 81.
And this is very interesting because here, this author is implying that the depositors knew that the banks were making those investments with their deposits, but they didn't care as long as they had the convenience of transferring their money on the books.
Yeah.
And today I don't think people think of banking like that, local banking like that. You know. I think I saw once a questionnaire, and a third of the people think that their money is sitting in the bank, and the other two thirds knows there's money not in the bank, but they still think it's their money. I don't know where they think it is, but so here's the Italian merchant bankers, the international banking. International banking created short-term credit money as part of international transfers of funds. And we've talked about this. You see some pictures of these merchants around the different parts of the world, their agents buying what they need. International banking also created long-term credit money to fund wars. And I just want to really accentuate this, because this is what has gone on in the history of the world. If you don't, you know, if you don't have money, you can't fight. You can't fight. You can't buy those weapons.
Look at all the millions of people up there in those little crow's nests.
Look at that.
Yeah, these illustrations.
Wow. That's
funny.
Look at all that armor.
Mm-hmm.
All that armor. Wow.
Did anybody ever see? Oh, in the Metropolitan Museum, there is a medieval court where they have a beautiful, large assembly of coats of armor.
That. I remember that.
And horses, you know, for horses, and then the riders. And Henry VIII's coat of arms, when he was about 45 years old, so he's a stout guy, it's off in the corner, and it's amazing to think that that was really his suit of armor. And he led some troops into battle at one point wearing that. And another thing about Henry VIII, a lot of people don't know, is that when he was a younger man, he participated in a joust. So he was in full armor, on the armored horse, with one of those poles, and he and the other guy galloped down at each other, and Henry was knocked off the horse. And the horse fell over and landed on Henry. And Henry almost died, and he had a lot of internal crushing, you know, and he was never right, especially his legs were never right. He was in constant pain for the rest of his life.
Oh.
Most people don't know that, but yeah, and I mean, it was weird that people would take such terrible, unnecessary risks, like in jousting, when there was no medical care to handle the injuries that would result from it.
Yeah, I don't know what the motivation was.
They didn't have television. If they were addicted to the TV, they would not have gotten into these problems.
They didn't have the internet.
What, Martin?
They didn't have the internet.
Yeah,
that's true.
Right. They didn't have the games to play. They could play games instead of actually getting on the horse with hundreds of pounds of armor on them. Oh, boy. Okay.
Now we have the National Football League.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what's going on in the other room.
And here's part six, the Hanseatic League, War on Credit.
Hanseatic League, 1179 to 1648.
Yeah.
The Hansa was a commercial and defensive confederation of 180 northern and central German merchant guilds and their market towns that dominated trade along the coast of northern Europe, peaked 1450. Their methods with trading partners included negotiation, suppression of trade, blockage resulting in famine, and war.
They don't sound too nice either.
No. Don't do it my way, I'll block you.
I don't know if it was in Stephen's book or in one of the other sources, but they said they blockaded Sweden and caused a huge famine.
Yeah.
Huge famine. I mean, it just, boy,
yeah,
it was rough. Rough. But you know, I had this question, you know, I never came across them much in any of the history. Have people come across them in any of the history?
I'm familiar with the term, the Hanseatic League, but I didn't know a thing about it.
How about you, Will and Martin?
I've heard of the Hanseatic League, and I knew there were a major element in the Baltic and northern Germany, but not much more than that.
I hadn't heard a thing about them.
And it's interesting that it's like so critical that they warred on the credit, you know. So if they had really had this history in our history, we'd say, oh, so maybe there's something wrong with private bankers, you know, having credit, you know. And of course, they probably would never mention something like that, right?
Okay. Well, I'm also struck by the fact that the modern Germans don't like modern Anglo-American banking practices. They're very conservative monetarily.
Yeah, they have different kinds of banks in Germany.
Yeah.
But they also have some multinational banks. I mean, a German bank is a member of the New York Federal Reserve.
Oh, yeah, the Deutsche Bank?
Yeah, Deutsche Bank. Pretty big here in New York. So some of the Hansa trades, and I'll just point out a few things. The chief cities are, you can see the pink around the black, so those are the chief cities. And the associated cities are all in black. Okay. The trade routes are in pink. And they put in where the fares are. They're a pink dot with black around them. And the important fares are the pink dot with the square. So you can see there's quite a number of fares in Europe. Okay. And this is a picture of some of their vessels. Big wooden ships, big. And you can see some of them with their wares on the.
How about that machine on the left with a wheel going around the bottom?
Oh, I think it's what is that called?
It's a crane.
A crane. A crane. Look at that! Oh my goodness! Wow! Boy, oh boy. Yeah. They had quite traded all up and down that Baltic Sea. And the Hanseatic League, here's a picture of their judging rule-breaking traders who look very frightened at this point.
Yes.
Yeah, they didn't, you know, they didn't, They were pretty strict when it came to money. And here's a warehouse of the Hansa in London. So they in different of the big trading cities, they would have warehouses where their boats could park and put out their, you know, store their wares, or they could sleep there, they have housing. So they're pretty extensive. Will, I think you're next.
The Hansa had no monetary power. The Hansa would not use credit and trade. Credit accused of instability of prices, increased risk-taking, and unscrupulous schemes.
They didn't trust the bankers at all. And you see this nice banker here, you know, with his little book. They're so innocuous with their, you know, with their little statements and books and everything. Warren, you want to do this one?
Yeah. Struggle over the money power, the Hansa's war on credits. 1389, credit war begun. Duke of Burgundy adopted hard money and caused severe deflation in Bruges. Bills of exchange were ordered to be paid in coinage and not by crediting accounts at the bank. Silver was demonetized since bills had to be paid in gold. The decreased volume of money benefited the landry gentry, clergy, rentiers, since rents remained constant. But the Bruges treasurer was nearly killed by an angry mob. This resulted in their rents escaping, in the rent scale back.
Yeah.
1401 repealed.
I love that. Let's see if I do this. There's the mob. Oh boy. This Hanse's war on credit failed. In 1401, the Hanse obtained the abolition of all credit transactions in Flanders for 3 years on buying and selling with foreigners. In 1433, they suppressed all bankers, foreign and domestic. In 1488, the Medici branch liquidated itself in Bruges and moved out. The largest banks were international and moved to Antwerp to capture the trade around the Cape of Good Hope, which was coming around 1503, and Bruges went into a decline. So the bankers moved, the trade route moved.
If you don't treat us nice, we're going to leave.
That's right. That's what they say, you know, if you don't give us tax breaks, we'll go to another state.
Yeah.
And there you can see
or lax regulations.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's it.
Oh, I thought you were going to give us a test.
No. No. This is quite a long century. Boy, so much. So much change.
And you didn't even talk about the history and the wars and the princes of little look that was going on around that.
No. I wanted to stay focused on the money and
much.
The credit. Money and credit.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, where are we? When are we meeting again?
In 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
Is that the Sunday after?
That would be. The 5th, I think.
Yeah, the 5th.
Yeah.
After the new year.
Yeah, January the 5th.
So there are parts of the chapter I didn't cover, like the Fuggers and stuff. I mean, if people want to talk about it, we can talk about it. They were another merchant bank, German merchant bank, you know.
Yeah.
Let me just see. I have here. I'm going to put some of these sources up on the website.
Okay.
You know. And I started through a timeline, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it this time. I'm just going to focus on the concepts, because I tried to do a timeline and it went on for like 6 feet. I was like, oh no, so much was going on. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh, I wanted to read this because this relates to Stephen. This is from De Ruyter, De Ruyter's book. And it's chapter 12. And I'll read a little, and I'll pass it to you to read too. In the field of medieval history, there is perhaps no topic which has given rise to more confusion than money. Although much has been written on the subject, there are very few satisfactory treatises. The reason is obvious. The solution of an economic problem rests on a correct interpretation of the facts. If the facts are misrepresented, or if the interpretation of them is based on a false theory, the whole analysis is likely to suffer from this initial mistake. Most of the writings on money in the Middle Ages are deficient in one respect or the other, and are therefore misleading, if not entirely worthless. Keep that in mind. One cause of the lack of reliable studies is that economists and historians have failed to cooperate. Much writing has been done either by historians who could read documents but were ignorant of economic problems, or by economists who were admirable in their logic, but unfortunately wrong about their facts. Sound familiar? However, most of the work on medieval money has been done neither by historians nor by economists, but by numismatists. They certainly deserve great credit for the publication of valuable source material, but their commentaries on the sources have usually been valueless from the standpoint of economic history. The reason is that numismatists look at monetary problems from a collector's point of view and are more interested in the identification of particular coins than in money as a standard of value or medium of exchange. So I thought this was interesting, because this is very much the theme of Stephen's book. Yeah. You know, is that if money has never been clearly taught or defined to people in history, you know. So there's a lot of work to do, you know. There's a lot there. I'm constantly just, you know, surprised that these different pieces of history that I learn from a monetary point of view, that I say, whoa, this is so important, and it's not anywhere that I've come in contact with. I mean, it's pretty awesome. You know, what all the people think?
I think that not many people are really interested in what is money. They think they know what it is.
My experience is that most people still think about it's the model is the prince's money, and not the bankers creating money out of thin air.
Yeah, they think the government creates the money.
Yeah.
Yes, that's such a misrepresentation. Oh, yeah. My God.
Well, my father took my brothers and me to Washington to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, where we watched the machines cranking out all those paper bills, all the money. So for sure I thought the government made the money. I didn't know about accounting entries and bank entries and all that.
Wow.
Who teaches you that?
It's so hard because the accounting is so conceptual. It's nothing you can put your hand around,
yeah.
Like a $20 bill, you know?
Yeah. Because you have to get people to put down their preconceived notions explicitly when talking to other people about this.
But they get scared by bookkeeping.
Well, you don't have to use the word bookkeeping.
What do you call it?
Yeah.
What do you call it?
It's a good question, actually. Most people are comfortable with the notion of a loan. Perhaps that's the way to go about it. Have we lost people?
No, I'm listening.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that, you know, most people are comfortable with the idea of a loan. And then you actually mention the fact that the bank doesn't have that money. They just make this loan, and that's the actual creation of money.
At that point.
The loan is creating money.
That's good. I like that.
And people know computers. So
yeah.
if you give them an example, let's say you go into the bank and you ask for a loan of $20,000. Do you think they have $20,000 in the vault and they're going to walk out with a couple bags of money and send you home with it? No! They don't even have that much money back there. They go into the computer. And they look up your account, and they add $20,000 to it.
So you don't even have to talk about bookkeeping.
No.
Or debits or credits or anything like that. I like that. I like that. That's good. That's really helpful.
Well, I like my example.
What's that?
When I go to McDonald's to get a cup of senior coffee, that's 50 cents.
Well, I had no idea it was so cheap.
Yeah, I put in my, I swipe my Chase credit card, and at that instant, or the instant before that, that money did not exist. But when I swipe that card, that money exists.
Credit card.
Yeah, you don't even have to go to the bank.
Because you're going into overdraft, just like those local gyro bankers.
It's a loan. It's not an overdraft. It's a loan that I've agreed to pay interest on.
It's a credit line, right?
No, I have a credit line, but that isn't the credit line. It's deducted from the credit line, but that's new money right then.
When I swipe that card,
that's created money.
Right.
50 cents.
But
50 cents plus 4 cents tax.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But an overdraft in an account is brand new money.
No, it's not an overdraft. It's a loan.
Yeah.
It's a loan. It's not an overdraft.
Right.
They've agreed to loan me that money.
You're right. But on top of that, I'm also just saying that if you took an overdraft in your checking account, that would be new money.
Yeah. Well, I don't have that kind of agreement. This is new money. This is new money. It didn't exist before I swiped my credit card.
Right.
Yeah. And then it'll go away when I pay my credit card bill at the end, if I pay for my cup of coffee.
And it's unsecured, except it's somewhat secured by your credit rating, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Because if you don't pay it, then...
They shouldn't have done that.